following is a production of the Media Ministry at New Salem Baptist Church in Soddy Daisy, Tennessee, featuring the teaching of Pastor Alan Rogers. In the Metro Chattanooga area, we invite you to be our guest at any of our weekly worship services or visit us online at newsalembaptist.net. Now here's Pastor Alan.
When it comes down to it, when you strip away everything else, what is it you're leaning on for your sense of significance, security, and salvation? What's your go-to? What's your rock? Now, we know how the Apostle Paul would answer that question. He would probably answer pretty much like he does later in this letter that we've been looking at in Galatians 2:20, where he says, I have been crucified with Christ. It's no longer I who live, but Christ lives in me. And the life which I now live in the flesh, I live by faith in the Son of God, who loved me and gave himself up for me. In so many words, that's it. That's the gospel. It's all about Jesus, who he was and what he has done for us, and our faith in that sacrifice. That's the thing that I'm clinging to, Paul would say, to give me identity and meaning and hope for the future. But there are some people who say that's not enough, who say that, well, what you really need is Jesus plus something else. Maybe it's Jesus plus this ritual, Jesus plus this code of behavior, Jesus plus this set of doctrines, Jesus plus this style of culture. Jesus, in our day, increasingly we see people say, well, you need to have Jesus plus this movement here, or Jesus plus this political party. And you could name all other kinds of things that people try to tack on to Jesus and say, it's Jesus plus this. Unless you have this, you're not really truly a Christian. And the problem is, if you stop and think about it, if you're trusting in Jesus plus something else, you're not really trusting in Jesus, are you? What you're really doing is you're trusting in whatever it is you're tacking on to Jesus. You're saying that's the most important thing. You're saying Jesus is not enough. But the gospel says, yes, he is. And that's the point that Paul has been trying to drive home in this letter that he wrote to the churches in Galatia in the late 40s AD. It's a message that today we desperately need to hear if we're going to understand the gospel and we're going to unlock the riches the gospel offers us. In the previous paragraph, if you think back a couple of weeks, we had a guest speaker last week, but a couple of weeks ago we looked at the first half of this story that Paul's laying out here. Paul began sharing part of his personal experience, his personal testimony of how Christ had confronted him, had changed the entire direction of his life, and had called him into ministry. And in this paragraph we're looking at today, Paul's going to continue that story. Now, because this is biographical material, I'm going to warn you, it's a little hard to kind of, it's really kind of a challenge to tease out exactly how this applies to us today, 2,000 years removed. But there are some important things here in Paul's story. This story presents some important truths about the gospel, the good news, that we would do well to embrace. And first and foremost, the gospel tells us, or calls us to embrace a person, not a culture. The gospel calls us to embrace a person, not a culture. In Galatians chapter 2, look at verses 1 through 3. Then after an interval of 14 years, I went up again to Jerusalem with Barnabas, taking Titus along also. It was because of a revelation that I went up, and I submitted to them the gospel which I preach among the Gentiles. But I did so in private to those who were of reputation, for fear that I might be running or had run in vain. But not even Titus, who was with me, though he was a Greek, was compelled to be circumcised. What's going on here? Well, as Paul continues to share his story, he relates a second visit he made to the city of Jerusalem to consult with some of Jesus' original disciples. You may remember in the first half of this story, he talked about a visit he made about 3 years after his conversion, where he went in, he met with the apostle Peter, you know, Peter, the leader of the 12, the pastor of that first church there in Jerusalem. And he spent a few days with him, kind of, you know, getting to know him. And then he says, and I didn't go back for some time later. Most likely, this visit that he's talking about here in Galatians chapter 2 occurred about 14 years after Paul's conversion, 11 years after that initial meeting with Peter. And figuring out the chronology of Paul's career is a little bit of a challenge. I'm just going to warn you. Because the only sources of knowledge we have about Paul's life come from little references he makes in some of his letters and from accounts shared by his friend Luke in the book of Acts, which is also in the New Testament. But because Luke, we know, edited and condensed material in order to fix the broader purpose of why he wrote Acts, the narrative he was trying to lay out in Acts, if you try to harmonize some of the things that Luke conveys and some of the things that Paul talks about, you're going to drive yourself nuts trying to figure out how that puzzle works together, because they're not designed to work together. They're all true, but they don't fit together real cleanly because the two men were writing for different purposes at different times. And plus, Paul gives us, you know, maybe details that Luke wasn't fully aware of. So I'm just going to warn you there. We're not exactly sure. When I say most likely that this is a visit 14 years after he was converted, it's because the details that Paul mentions here in this passage seem to best match up with an episode that Luke describes back in Acts chapter 11. And if you want to hold your finger there and flip back to Acts 11, you can do that. But let me just give you the 30,000 view summary here, okay? In Acts 11, Luke describes how the apostle Peter, again, the leader of the 12, the first pastor of the church in Jerusalem, he reported to that church how God had led him to share the gospel with the family of a Roman centurion named Cornelius. That's recorded in Acts chapter 10. And he relayed how as he preached the gospel to these people, these non-Jews responded and gave evidence of receiving genuine salvation through Jesus. They had a very similar experience that the early church had on the day of Pentecost described in Acts chapter 2 when the Holy Spirit came upon Jesus' original disciples and the first church was born. And why is that important? Well, because, remember, all of Jesus' original disciples came out of a context of Judaism. They were all Jewish. Jesus was Jewish. Jesus was born in the Jewish homeland. Jesus grew up participating in Judaism. Jesus fulfilled scripture or prophecies preached by Jewish prophets as he demonstrated himself to be the Jewish Messiah. So those early disciples come out of this context of Judaism, and in Judaism they had this idea that they were God's chosen people. And anybody outside of that covenant community, well, those filthy non-Jews were just all going to go to hell. I mean, that's kind of a rough way of saying it, but they believed they were the ones that had the light and the truth, and God only dealt with them, and everybody else could just go pound sand. Even though several of the Jewish prophets had said down through the years, one day God is going to bring people from those non-Jewish nations into his kingdom. Somehow they missed that prophecy. Some of them did anyway. But Peter is coming back to the church of Jerusalem and he's saying, listen, this is happening. I preach the gospel and all these ungodly, unrighteous, dirty, non-Jewish people, they responded to the gospel. They got saved. And they demonstrated that it was genuine, it was real. And this blew their world. It turned their paradigm upside down. Because all of a sudden they realized, wow, this gospel thing, Jesus really is for everybody. He's not just for a little narrowly defined group of people. He's for everybody. That's in Acts 11 verses 1 through 18. In verses 19 through 21 there in Acts 11, we see how some of these disciples from the church at Jerusalem fled persecution. They went to the city of Antioch in Syria, and they helped found a second church there. And in this second church, a large number of the non-Jewish population was converted to faith in Christ. So they have a new church. Some of the people that came into that church came from the Jewish background, like the original church had, but some of them were non-Jews. Again, just blowing their world. They didn't think this was possible, and yet God was doing it through the proclamation of Jesus and what he had done. And so the church in Jerusalem heard about this going on in Antioch, and they sent a guy named Barnabas up to Antioch to check things out. And Barnabas decided, hey, I want to take somebody with me. So he recruited this former rabbi named Paul, who had once been a persecutor of the church, but who now says God had called him to preach the gospel of Jesus. And so Barnabas takes Paul up to Antioch, and they stay there for a year, proclaiming the gospel, evangelizing, and discipling new converts there in that church, primarily among people who came from a non-Jewish background, who hadn't grown up reading the scriptures all their lives. You know, we would consider these are people today who were unchurched, people who didn't know the scriptures, who came from a totally far away from God background, and yet when they heard about Jesus, they were drawn to him, and they responded. And the church at Antioch, we read later in Acts chapter 11, they responded to a prophecy about an upcoming famine by taking up a collection, kind of like we did a few minutes ago, and sending that relief fund to Jerusalem, and they tapped Barnabas and Paul to be the ones to take that money safely to Jerusalem. And we read about this in Acts 17, verses 27 through 30. And this is what it says. Now, at this time, some prophets came down from Jerusalem to Antioch. One of them named Agabus stood up and began to indicate by the Spirit that there would certainly be a great famine all over the world. And this took place in the reign of Claudius, talking about the Roman emperor there. In the proportion that any of the disciples had means, each of them determined to send a contribution for the relief of the brethren living in Judea. And this they did, sending it in charge of Barnabas and Saul, or Paul, to the elders. Talking about the pastors there of that first church in Jerusalem. The reason they did this is historically, the church in Jerusalem was known to be, those believers struggled. They were shut out from the community. They didn't have a lot of economic opportunities open to them, and so they were really struggling. That was well known, and the famine hit that area particularly hard. So the folks in Antioch, the brothers and sisters in Antioch, took up a collection to help their brothers and sisters in Jerusalem. So here you have these non-Jewish believers crossing the line to help the Jewish believers in the first church. That's important. That's key to what Paul is getting ready to relay here. Remember that Paul wrote this letter, as we've talked about before, in part to respond to allegations that he had not preached the whole truth to the Galatians. Sometime after Paul planted these churches in Galatia, which is in central Turkey, other teachers came in behind him, who tried to subvert these churches by undermining the legitimacy of Paul's ministry. Believe it or not, that's got some connection to us today, because you know, all I got to do is just go to Twitter, and I can see examples of stuff like this, where you have somebody trying to gain a following for themselves by tearing down somebody else, right? So that's what's happening here in Galatia. Paul comes in, plants these churches, other people come in, and they're saying, you know, you guys don't want to follow Paul. No, you need to listen to us. They were trying to convince the Galatians that in order to become a true Christian, one first had to adopt all the rituals and religious regulations of Judaism. Remember, Christianity started out as a Jewish movement. And so they're saying if you want to be a good Christian, you first have to become a good Jew. And that's not what Paul had preached in non-Jewish Galatia. And the ways that these teachers tried to undermine Paul was, first of all, they claimed that Paul had not been called by Christ, that he had received his teaching and his ministry from those original disciples in Jerusalem, and to claim that Paul had watered down the gospel he received in Jerusalem so he would not offend the Galatians and he would gain a following among them. And again, that's something I could spend 10 minutes on Twitter and show you examples of probably today. Of somebody saying, well, you know, so-and-so, they're not a true preacher. They're just trying to gain a following, so they're not telling you the whole gospel. They're trying to tickle your ears. That's a charge that gets thrown around even today. So they're saying, Paul didn't tell you that you needed to adopt Judaism because he didn't want to offend all of you. He wanted you to listen to him and to follow him. So he kept back stuff that was important from you. And so Paul is writing to respond to those charges. Now, even though Paul claimed to have received his teachings and his calling directly from Jesus, as laid out in Acts chapter 9, he did take opportunity of this trip to Jerusalem to consult with some of those original apostles. In the previous paragraph, in chapter 1, verses 11 through 24, Paul had made clear he received his conversion and calling independent of those apostles. He met Christ personally on that road to Damascus, and it was Christ who called him into ministry. His understanding of the gospel came from that encounter with Christ and from meditating on his own voluminous knowledge of the Jewish scriptures under the leadership of God's Spirit. He said it was 3 years before he went to Jerusalem. He'd been preaching the gospel for 3 years before he went to have this meeting with Peter that he talks about in chapter 1. So while we're delivering this relief fund, 11 years later from Antioch, Paul takes the opportunity to consult in private. Notice he says this takes place in private with some of those influential leaders of the original church. He tells us now in verse 9, he met with three men. He met with Peter. He met with another apostle, John, the writer of the gospel of John that is. And then he meets with James, who technically was not an apostle, but he was the half-brother of Jesus. James was a very influential figure in that Jerusalem church. After Peter left to go elsewhere, James was kind of looked at as one of the pastors of that church. Tradition and history tell us a lot about him. But if you remember from the Gospels, he didn't really believe Jesus' claims until after the resurrection. You know, that was his story. He thought his half-brother was a little cuckoo until after the resurrection when he couldn't deny it anymore, and he became a believer. And then after that, he became a leader in the early church. Paul tells us he did not seek out this meeting because he needed approval from these apostles, but to make sure they were all on the same page, that they were all proclaiming the same message. When he says in verse 2, he went to those who had reputation for fear I might be running or had run in vain. Now, that doesn't mean Paul was worried, oh man, did I get the gospel wrong? That's not what he's saying there. Because remember, he understood that his calling, his authority had come directly from Jesus. So he's not worried about he's preaching the wrong thing. He's convinced that he has it straight from the horse's mouth. He also understood the importance of being in alignment with the leaders of that early church, with the original disciples, the 12. If the original apostles were to come out as opposed to Paul's message, opposed to his ministry in the non-Jewish territories, then that would undermine his ministry and it would also disrupt the unity of the entire church at large. You wouldn't have one church under one Lord and Savior. You would have two separate churches. You'd have a Jewish church and you'd have a non-Jewish church, a Gentile church. And that's not what Paul wanted to see happen. To him, the gospel is about breaking down those barriers, not about having separate but equal. So he goes to consult with these apostles to make sure we're all on the same page, aren't we, guys? And these influential leaders in the original church not only approved Paul's message, they accepted his non-Jewish companion. Because on this trip, Paul and Barnabas had also brought along a non-Jewish convert named Titus. Now, they call Titus a Greek. That doesn't mean he was literally from the nation of Greece. That means that he was Greek-speaking. He lived according to Greek culture, which a lot of people in the Roman Empire did, no matter where you came from. Titus was probably from Antioch, but he lived according to non-Jewish culture. And part of that was Titus had not been circumcised as a young man. Under Paul's preaching, Titus had put his faith in Jesus, but he had not adopted Jewish culture there in that church in Antioch. And circumcision was a huge, huge deal in Judaism at this time. In fact, circumcision had been a key part of the Jewish experience going all the way back to Abraham about 2,000 years before Jesus. In Genesis 17, verses 1 through 14, and I'm not going to read the whole thing, but verse 9, we read, God said further to Abraham, and Genesis 17 is one of the covenants that God, the agreements that God makes with Abraham. In verse 9 he says, now as for you, you shall keep my covenant, you and your descendants after you throughout their generations. This is my covenant which you shall keep between me and you and your descendants after you. Every male among you shall be circumcised. But an uncircumcised male, verse 14, an uncircumcised male who is not circumcised in the flesh of his foreskin, that person shall be cut off from his people. He has broken my covenant. So ever since Abraham, nearly 2,000 years before Jesus, circumcision had been a huge, huge part of Jewish identity. That was the sign for Jewish males that they were part of the covenant people. And they had been taught all their lives, this is the sign. And if you don't participate in this, you're not part of the group. So now the gospel is spilling outside that group. And so the question is, well, does that mean these people coming in from the outside, they need to undergo this? Because circumcision is a sign of belonging to God's covenant people. In fact, in the first century AD, if a non-Jew, if one of these Greeks, so to speak, had wanted to convert to Judaism, then they would have to go undergo that ritual. They'd have to have that surgery. That's the difference. If you read the New Testament, you read about the so-called God-fearers. It talks about Gentiles who participate in the synagogue. They're called God-fearers. They're not called proselytes. That's the dividing line. Before they could actually convert, as long as they didn't convert, they would be on the periphery. They'd be God-fearers, but they wouldn't be part of the group. It's only when they submitted to that ritual then they could be considered actual converts to Judaism. So circumcision is often used as a shorthand for adopting a whole Jewish identity. So that's the question. In order to become a good Christian, you have to adopt everything else that comes with Jewish identity. And these original apostles in Jerusalem, who were all Jewish, who all grew up, you know, practicing all these things, keeping kosher, keeping the feast days, observing the 613 commandments of the Jewish law, they looked at this Greek, Titus, and they accepted him as a true disciple. And Paul makes a big deal about the fact they did not require him to adopt a Jewish identity to be considered part of the group. The takeaway for us is that a relationship with Jesus through faith is more important than engaging in particular rituals or embracing a particular culture. Because that's really, when we talk about Jewish identity, that's what we're talking about. You have to change your culture in order to follow Jesus. So what does a true Christian look like? Can you tell a true Christian by the way they dress? Yeah, this is kind of a thing in missionary circles sometimes. It's so weird. You look at places where missionaries have gone and say, for example, Africa. And the next thing you know, all the men in the church are wearing suits and ties like Americans. And they're singing American hymns with, you know, Swahili lyrics or something like that. And they're adopting mannerisms and things of Americans. Does that make them Christians? Not unless they know Jesus. It just makes them American clones. Because it's not how you dress or the songs you sing or the way you talk that make you a Christian. It's your faith in the Lord Jesus Christ. In Jesus' death, burial, and resurrection. Is that your rock? See, it's not a cultural thing. And sometimes we have trouble sorting that out, even today. We have trouble sorting out how much of what we do is actually determined by our tradition and culture, and how much of it is really focused on Jesus. And that was Paul's deal. This is all about Jesus and what he's done for us. All that other stuff, now it can be important, but it's not what makes you right with God. See, if your answer to that question, what does a true Christian look like? If your answer is anything other than looking like Jesus and our character, well, then you're looking at the wrong things. That was a lot about the first point. You're sitting there going, man, he's got like four more to go. How are we going to do this? Relax. That first one was hugely important. That's the foundation. See, this attempt to add anything alongside Jesus betrays a lack of faith in Jesus. If you don't hear anything else I say today, hear that. The attempt to add something alongside Jesus, Jesus plus, that actually betrays a lack of faith in Jesus. In verse 4, Paul talks about it. Says, it was because of false brethren secretly brought in, who had sneaked in to spy out our liberty, which we have in Christ Jesus, in order to bring us into bondage. Now, Paul is getting really... this is an incomplete sentence. Here's what a lot of scholars suspect is happening. Paul is he's dictating this letter to a secretary, okay? And the secretary is writing down what Paul is saying, and that's going to get sent out to the churches. And Paul is getting really worked up about this whole incident. This thing is so raw. It is so personal. He is getting wound up. And so he's just shooting. He's changing the subject. He's leaving sentences incomplete because he is starting to get his blood up here because he is so mad about what happened in this incident with these false teachers who were trying to confuse people. And so that's why it reads, if you think it reads weird in English, you ought to try translating it from Greek. And I'm not the best Greek scholar. But I tell you, it's wild because he doesn't follow normal grammar. He doesn't follow normal rules of syntax. And what it is he's getting so worked up, he's just spitting out words, okay? You ever done that? You ever been in that situation? But he's talking about, as he is visiting this church, trying to compare notes here, even though the apostles that Paul consulted with accepted Titus without requiring him to adopt Jewish culture, Paul indicates that there were others in Jerusalem who did not. And at this point, Paul doesn't explicitly identify who those people were, but we encounter similar people in other parts of the New Testament. In Acts chapter 15, Luke describes a party of teachers from the Jerusalem church who came to the church in Antioch and insisted that the non-Jewish disciples there had to adopt Jewish identity. And again, let me just say this to be very clear, because I hope you're not taking the wrong idea here. I'm not condemning Jewish identity. Okay, in fact, I have a lot of respect for Jewish people and people who've grown up Jewish. But what I'm saying is that you do not have to adopt Jewish identity in order to be a follower of Jesus. And anybody who attempts to impose any other identity on top of a relationship with Christ, doesn't matter if it's Jewish or whatever, then that's not the true gospel. And I think Paul would agree with that. But in Acts 15, these teachers come in and they're telling the church at Antioch, most of whom grew up non-Jewish, well, if you want to be a good Christian, you got to become a good Jew first. Acts 15:1, there were some men who came down from Judea. And when it says come down from Judea, that's because in Jewish thinking, Jerusalem's the center of the universe. And it's up on a mountain anyway. So anywhere in the Holy Land you go to Jerusalem, you are having to go up. And anywhere you go away from there, you're traveling downhill. So they said they come, even though Antioch is north of Jerusalem, they're northeast of Jerusalem, they're saying they came down from Judea and began teaching the brethren, unless you're circumcised according to the custom of Moses, you cannot be saved. So guys line up for surgery. Paul says, no. This controversy actually led to a council in Jerusalem. We read about in Acts 15, where the leadership of the Jerusalem church got together and they discussed this. Is this true? Do you have to adopt a Jewish identity in order to be a good Christian? And you can go read that debate in Acts 15, and what they came down in, essentially the answer is no. Okay? You don't. Now, as Paul develops his argument here in Galatians, he's going to warn those who try to impose circumcision, Jewish identity, on other people. He says that's not what the gospel proclaims. What's clear is that in Acts 2, verse 4, Paul, he doesn't come right out and tell us exactly who these people are, but he does say he considers them not to be true disciples. Because first of all, he calls them false brethren. So Paul is not playing nice here. This is so important. This is so critical. And what these people are doing is so destructive and so spiritually poisonous that Paul doesn't even give them the benefit of the doubt. He says, these people are not true believers. They are no brothers of mine, because they're confusing people and leading them away from Jesus by trying to impose all this other stuff on top of them. That's pretty strong language right there. But that tells you how seriously Paul takes this. And perhaps maybe it suggests how seriously we should take it as well. He says they're false brethren. He accuses them of acting in bad faith. First of all, he says they were secretly brought in. It sounds like a James Bond movie, doesn't it? They snuck in. He said they came in to, and the other phrase is, they came in to spy out our liberty. Does that sound like somebody who's acting in good faith? No. What does Paul mean here by their liberty? He also says they came in to do this to bring us into bondage, to try to put chains on people. See, in Paul's viewpoint, to insist that we need something more than faith in Jesus is to say, well, Jesus is not enough. When we attempt to add anything to Jesus, we're betraying that we're really not trusting in Jesus. We're trusting in what we're adding to him. So when somebody says, well, what you need, you know, if you're going to be a true Christian, then you have to believe this doctrine, this doctrine, this doctrine, this doctrine. Well, listen, some of those doctrines are important. And I say this as somebody who majored in theology, okay? I love doctrine. I've studied a lot of doctrine. But not all doctrines created equally. Now, there's some doctrines, you begin tugging on those threads, and if you pull that out, you're going to undermine the entire gospel. So you can't, you know, like if you were to say, well, you know, I'm going to deny that Jesus is both fully God and fully human, that's a no-go, because then you undermine the gospel. But there are lots of other things that are further down the list of priorities that Christians of good faith have legitimate disagreements about. We read the same Bible, but one person reads a passage and says, well, I think it says this. Another person reads and says, well, I think it says something different. And we have legitimate points of disagreement on that. And it is not healthy on those secondary and tertiary issues to start pointing fingers at people and say, well, because you don't agree with me, you're not a Christian. And yet, everywhere we look today, we see that kind of charge being thrown around. Don't believe me? Have you been on Facebook? Don't dare go on Twitter. Trust me. I would never tell anybody to go on Twitter, because it can be a cesspool sometimes. But you'll see it. It's there. But then it's part of this whole partisanship thing that we've kind of bought into in our society. It even affects relations between believers, people who should have something important in common. We should be united by Jesus. And yet, because I don't like the way you tie your shoes, you're a heathen. We got to be careful about that stuff, folks. Doctrine's important. Some doctrines are more important than others, but is our faith in our doctrine, in our doctrinal statement, or is our faith in Jesus? Here's a silly one. Political affiliation, okay? And I say it's silly because, unfortunately, though, Christians judge each other. You know, we all, Republicans look at all Democrats and say, they're heathens. Democrats look at Republicans and say, they're Nazis. I mean, that you can't be following Jesus? Well, no, you can't be following Jesus. Hey, folks, I found believers in both parties. Now, I may not agree with all of them on everything. There's some things that some parties stand for that I find abhorrent and ungodly. Issues like abortion. But the most important thing is not who your voter registration is with. It's who your faith is in. What's your rock? All this raises an important question that Paul is going to deal with later in this letter, okay? And this, some people say, well, what does this mean about, what about if the law is not important, why did God give us the Ten Commandments? Why did God give us all these rituals in the Old Testament, these sacrifices and stuff in the Old Testament? Why did God give us all these things we're told to do and not do in the Old Testament? If that's not really important, then why is it there? Did God change his mind? No. And Paul actually deals with this later in Galatians. I don't want to take a lot of time to do that this morning because we're going to get to it eventually. But basically it boils down to this. Some of the laws in the Old Testament point us to Jesus. They show us why we need a Savior. And they show us the futility of trying to save ourselves. In other aspects, some of those laws were fulfilled by Jesus on our behalf. He has made them obsolete. Okay? We'll get more into that when we get there. But I just want to let you know. Now, here's another difference as well. When we decide to follow Jesus, we don't obey in order to receive salvation. We obey Jesus because we have received salvation. Van talked about this some last week. Those of you who were with Van Ferguson, you know, he quoted that verse, if you love me, you will keep my commandments, right? We don't obey Jesus so that hopefully he'll love us. No, we obey Jesus because we love him. And if you love somebody, you want to make them happy, right? It's the difference between having Jesus in your rearview mirror and having Jesus out in front of you. See, if you're following Jesus, he should be out in front of you, and so you're running to catch up. That doesn't mean you're there yet, but you're moving towards him. It's not about what we do, it's about what he's done. But we seek to honor him, we seek to have his character developed in us because we love him. We'll get more into that as we go, but real quick, I'll say this. There's no compromise with attempts to add extra conditions to the gospel. In verse 5, he says, we did not yield to subjection to them even an hour, talking to these false teachers, so that the truth of the gospel would remain with you. And that's why he didn't budge an inch. He would not compromise with these other teachers. Why? For the sake of people like the folks in Galatia. Because he didn't want them being led astray. He didn't want them to be given a false path to salvation. He wanted them to know the truth. That was a hill he was willing to die on. And then finally, the basis for fellowship and partnership rests on the essentials of the gospel, not on the extras. In verses 6 through 10, but from those who were of high reputation, what they were makes no difference to me. God shows no partiality. Well, those who were of reputation contributed nothing to me. On the contrary, seeing that I am entrusted with the gospel to the uncircumcised, just as Peter has been to the circumcised, for he who effectively worked for Peter in his apostleship to the circumcised effectively worked for me also to the Gentiles. And recognizing the grace that had been given to me, James and Cephas and John, who were reputed to be pillars, gave to me and Barnabas the right hand of fellowship, so that we might go to the Gentiles and they to the circumcised. They only asked us to remember the poor, the very thing I also was eager to do. Let me see if I can summarize that real quick. Paul is attempting to walk a careful line here between respecting the authority of the original apostles and not placing them on a pedestal. That's what he means when he says, but those who were of high reputation and what they, you know, it doesn't really matter to me what he's saying there. He wants to respect, yeah, Peter's got a special place. James has got a special place. John's got a special place. But you know what? They're not Jesus. So he respects them. But see, we have this bad tendency sometimes in church that we have a leader who's got some kind of position or authority. We place them up on a pedestal. And all of a sudden we treat everything they say as if it is inerrant and infallible. This is the only thing inerrant and infallible right here. Okay? Do not place me on a pedestal. You know why? It gives me much further room to fall. Don't want to be on any pedestal. We're brothers and sisters. Okay? Don't look at any pastor, any preacher, any evangelist and put them up on a pedestal. They're fallible. Sooner or later, they're going to let you down. Only person you need to put on that pedestal is Christ, because he will never let you down. So Paul says, I respect them. And he also recognized, hey, we both serve the same gospel. They looked at Paul's ministry and they said, wow, people are coming to faith in Jesus. They're responding positively to the gospel. God is obviously working in him, just like, remember Acts chapter 11, when Peter went to Cornelius, they responded positively to the gospel as well. God was obviously doing something here. So they recognized they're on the same page. They're preaching the same gospel. They're seeing similar results. However, Paul and the apostles that he consulted with also recognized they ministered in different contexts. He was called to go to the non-Jewish world. They were called to minister primarily to their fellow Jews. Both are preaching the same gospel. They recognized they're in different contexts. And while their context might require them to utilize different methodologies, they were united under the same message and the same mission. It's not like, basically what they do is they form an agreement. They divide up a territory, they form an agreement. And this doesn't mean, well, Peter, you can only preach to the Jewish world, and Paul, you can only preach to the non-Jewish world, and you better stay in your lane. They're not going to be battling this out. What they're saying is generally, Paul's working in a Jewish community. That's going to affect how you present the gospel, okay? When you're talking with a community that primarily has a certain culture, a certain language, it affects how you present the gospel. For one thing, you can go to the scriptures, the Old Testament scriptures, and you can try to show from the Old Testament scriptures how Jesus fulfilled those scriptures. You can show how Jesus, like the writer of Hebrews does, how Jesus fulfilled a lot of the ritualism in Judaism. And that can be your approach to preaching to that group. But if you're like Paul and you're in primarily a non-Jewish context, you can't take that approach and really be effective. Because you start going to all these Jewish scriptures and these non-Jews are going to look at you and say, why should I listen to that? They don't know those scriptures. They don't accept those scriptures. You've got to find another way to build bridges between the scriptures and where they're at. It's kind of like what our missionaries have to go through when they go into another country. They got to learn the language. They got to learn the culture. They've got to take the gospel. Now, the gospel doesn't change, but they got to find ways to build a bridge from the gospel to that culture so those people will hear and they'll be able to understand. And so they recognize, hey, we've got these two different contexts we're working in. We're going to have to approach this from different directions, but it's the same message. We're still preaching the same gospel. And we're fulfilling the same great commission. And, when they say, Paul, you go out there, man, you go out and you preach the gospel to the non-Jewish world. You win as many as you can. Just remember the poor. But this primarily means the poor people back in Jerusalem. Well, why was Paul in Jerusalem in the first place? He came to bring a relief fund to these brothers and sisters from the non-Jewish world to the Jewish brothers and sisters in Jerusalem. He says, guys, I'm already doing that. And he does it later in his career too. In fact, that's the thing that probably cost Paul his life. Because later in Acts, we read he collected another fund to take back to Jerusalem. And that's what put him in Jerusalem to get arrested and falsely charged. And have to end up appealing to Caesar and being sent to Rome. And probably eventually with his head being on the chopping block. Here's the wrap up. Do we really believe that Jesus is enough? Do we? Do we really believe that Jesus is enough? Or are we keeping people from Jesus by trying to impose conditions on them that Jesus never required? That's what they talk about in Acts 15 when they had this big discussion at that council. We're not going to raise any artificial barriers to keep people from Jesus. Yeah, there are things about our culture that we think are important, but from a gospel perspective, they're negotiable, and we don't want that to be a stumbling block for somebody. So you know what? We're just going to give them Jesus. What do the expectations that we place on ourselves and other people say about what we're really trusting in for our significance, our security, and ultimately our salvation? Think about what we expect from somebody who responds to the gospel. Are we just expecting them to enter a personal relationship with Jesus and walk with him by faith, trusting in his death, burial, and resurrection to be what makes them right with God? Or are we tacking on all kinds of extras, clouding the picture up, muddying the waters, and pushing people away from the gospel, making it harder for them to see Jesus? Folks, as we say we want to reach our community, that we really want to be God's lighthouse here in this corner of Soddy Daisy, that's a question we need to look at very, very seriously to make sure that what we're doing is holding up Jesus good and high so people can get a good look at him and not building a whole lot of walls around him to keep other people out.
This program is a production of the Media Ministry at New Salem Baptist Church. Music courtesy of Jason Shaw at audionautix.com. If you enjoy this program, we would love to hear from you. Email us at info@newsalembaptist.net. Thank you for listening.